Let's get down and dirty, guys. Don't you guys just miss Cinemax now and again?
Do I miss it?
I wouldn't say I miss it, Ash.
Do you miss watching scrambled Cinemax and like just praying that you'd see like a butt cheek or just something?
Man.
Welcome to Rated NA, the podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. This is episode number 266, and I'm your host, Matt.
And I'm Scott.
And I'm Ash.
And we are back from PAX and hanging out in our own rooms again.
It almost seems like a lifetime ago that we were at PAX. The time, for me at least, has passed by so quickly.
Yes.
Yeah, no, it does feel like, yeah. Yeah, it's crazy.
Like, went to a different planet, and then we came back to our world, and you know, I'm looking at Twitter, obviously, and you know, folks like Mylan, who we saw at PAX, are now at like South by Southwest, as I'm sure, like,
yeah.
You know, so there's just like another thing going on, and then, you know, all of a sudden we're kind of like, it's spring. This is the first day of spring, and it's just like, what happened? We're you know, we were just in a different place a month ago, and everything is different, guys.
Well, for you guys, it was like you traveled up north and dealt with snow for a few days. And
yeah,
I was just in Florida this weekend, so it was like fucking 80 degrees down there. I don't know how you guys got to move, man. That place is insane.
Yeah,
it doesn't make any sense.
I mean, I was not as stoked about the cold when I was up there either. So I guess it goes both
well,
ways.
Sure, but yeah. Like it's like 90. 24 hours a day in Florida all months of years. Yeah. Like it's ridiculous.
Not there's looking like, forward to the summer.
Yeah, you get like a month and a half of like 40s, and then it just shoots right back up to 90, like with nothing in between. It makes no sense. And I say this as a longtime Floridian. It's just, it's bonkers.
Yeah, I think it was.
That's why people do drugs and eat faces, Scott. That's why that
and
happens.
And eat faces and let their cobras out of the house and all manner of other things that happen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's why, yeah. That's why there's a python hunting club in the swamps, you know, like, because the heat gets to people. They don't know what to do anymore.
Let's do the rundown.
But anyways,
I have nothing to add to any of this.
Yeah, that's fine. That's why I'm just going to move us along. And so,
all right.
On this episode, we get to start talking about Star Wars Rogue One, and we get to start talking about Mass Effect Andromeda, which actually comes out tomorrow. But we, Ash and I both played trials of the game, if you will, plural.
Yeah.
And so I'm sure we'll get into that as well. And then I'm going to talk about a visual novel called We Eat Blood and All of Our Friends Are Dead. So stick around for that. And Matt's going to talk about Love Season 2 on Netflix.
Yeah.
So this episode is brought to you by Audible. You can go to audibletrial.com/ratedNA. And if you sign up with Audible through that link, you'll get a free audiobook download if you're a new subscriber. And you can cancel anytime, and it helps support the show if you do stick around. We hope that you do and you want to support the show, but I use Audible, and I'm listening to the Empire's End book, which is you know, as I'm listening to more and more of it, it definitely seems to have a much larger scope than the first two books did, and I'm kind of excited about that, because it's nice to see how these, like, well, what do you call them now, like the new expanded universe stories kind of like tie into the current timeline and where everything is headed. And I think you mentioned that this is tying into how the Battle of Jakku, right? That's kind of like where this is all headed.
Yeah, it's supposed to be just a massive, massive battle. So if you're into that sort of stuff, then check it out.
Yeah, and I also, my other kind of like thing that I like to do with Audible is I end up listening to a lot of those biographies, I guess. I don't know if you can call them biographies, because like people that are like our age are writing them, and it's like you're only... lived like less than half a life and you're already like writing your life story, you know. I think it kind of started with you know, Tina Fey's Bossy Pants kind of like, I think, set up a lot of the popularity of what you see now with a lot of people writing those you know, sometimes like a collection of essays or something, but like a lot of people have books like that now, like Nick Offerman and Mindy Kaling, a lot of other like comedians on television.
Yeah, so, Felicia Days was really good too.
Oh yeah, I listened to hers as well. That's right. Yeah, that
her,
one was
her. You can get hers on Audible, and she reads it. It's really, really well done.
Yeah, that's kind of what I like about those autobiographical audiobooks is when the author is the one that wrote it. And you know, if I could make another pick, as I'm sure many people did, you know, when Carrie Fisher passed away, I you know went to Audible and found the audiobook that she put out recently, which was like the one where she kind of gets into her whole thing with Harrison Ford from Star Wars and kind of like tells stories about that. And she is hilarious, as you probably already know, but that audiobook right. was kind of, it was kind of weird and bittersweet listening to that, you know, 'cause like, I don't think she expected that to be sort of the last thing she put out into the, you know, into the universe as a writer, but
right.
It's definitely an interesting read slash listen if you choose to get that one as well.
News.
The first bit of news has been kind of floating around for a while, but you know, if you followed the story of Rogue One at all, you're probably aware that the ending that we saw in the theaters wasn't the original ending of the film. And we even talked about it on our Rogue One special, but, you know, originally, a lot of different things were supposed to happen, and some of those things actually ended up getting filmed. But what the article goes on to describe is the original ending of Rogue One and how different it actually was. And the short version is we're going to spoil Rogue One now. So if you have not seen it, we're going to tell you what happens in the end, because we can't really tell you how it's different otherwise.
Yeah.
So spoiler alert for Rogue One, everybody dies. So in the original ending of Rogue One, everyone didn't die. And the reason, of course, was that they were unsure.
A bunch of people died. Just Jin and Cat. Why did I just forget his name?
You just made me forget
Cassian,
his name.
Cassian Andor.
Yes.
Yeah. Those two make it.
Right. Yeah. Those two make it in the original ending, and so they're actually supposedly whisked off the planet Scarif before it gets blown up by the Death Star. And there's a lot of other things that were different. Some of the casts actually weren't in the film at all in the original drafts, which I thought was really interesting. So like, some of the fan favorite characters, like I think K2SO was always in the film and K2SO always died. But, what's the monk character's name? I'm blanking right now.
I just listened to that book too, and I can't,
oh my gosh, we're terrible. We're terrible at this job.
Yeah.
Anyway, so some of the characters,
was it
Chirrut Imwe?
Cheer it.
Cheer everyone, it. Yes. Yeah. It was actually not in the original draft, which I thought was really interesting because he's one of the high points of the film. I just thought it was interesting that so much changed. And I, you know, we talked about this earlier when we were talking in our Rogue One special, but I feel like this movie was different up until like the day it came out. like they were like desperately placing footage together and like trying to salvage some semblance of like a narrative at the end, and in the end it ended up just like working by some fluke of magic, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And ended up being spectacular, but
I think some of this is like, so this article came out from Gary Whitta, right, who was talking about it in an interview, and this was stuff that wasn't shot, it was just original script essentially, or I don't even know if it was actually right. in the fully written out script, but kind of just written out that they would basically escape off the planet, and then that ship would explode, and they escaped off that ship into the unknown, kind of leading to believe that they're somewhere in the universe, but who knows where.
Interesting.
There's also some cool stuff that he said that, you know, when he originally wrote up the character of Jyn Erso was already in the rebellion, and she was a sergeant. She had a rank, and they were so far into production when they changed her origin story that they actually have figures in production that say Sergeant Jyn Erso.
Yeah.
So you can get these Sergeant Jyn Erso figures, but she's not a sergeant. She's just a criminal. So I guess it was changed late enough down the line that they were actually making toys of her that had like her original origin, you know, kind of slapped around that toy, which I think is pretty cool.
Hmm. Yeah. And, the director, Gareth Edwards.
Yep.
Yes.
He came out and said that a lot of the stuff that we saw in trailers that never showed up in the movie wasn't ever actually in the movie as well. That it wasn't stuff that got cut. Some of it was. The famous TIE fighter scene was one that got cut out. But the scene with like the lights around Jyn Erso, where she turns and like, the lights light up mm-hmm. down the hallway.
Yeah.
He said some of it was just visualizations that they had done that they thought would look cool, that they shot for kind of like, not, I don't know if it's B-roll necessarily. Like
reference,
but
reference footage or something?
Kind of reference footage or footage just to have in case they needed to edit it in, and they knew that they were like visually striking shots, so they kind of went with it. And like that was one of them, and I forget there was another one that he referenced. So it was really interesting because, and this is all coming out because of the Blu-ray, and I think that, you know, gag orders have been lifted kind of, and these guys can kind of talk a little more freely about Rogue One. But I think it's interesting that, like, you know, this movie clearly went through like a shifting process all the way, like you were saying, Ash. Like this was like writes and rewrites and then reshoots and edits out and like random B-roll in case they needed it. Like this is just, it's crazy that they put together such a tight-knit, like well-crafted story by the end of it with this amount of stuff going on. But I think it's pretty awesome.
I do too. And I'm glad that we kind of finally have at least an outline of what the original was like, just to kind of, you know, have that in the back of our heads, like, oh, in the original, you know, concept, she lives. And cool. I mean, I just think that's really neat.
And the movie, comes to digital on Friday. It's very soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Or did I say Blu-ray? Yeah, it's coming to digital this week.
Yeah, I think Blu-ray is like in the, you know, like in the, within like the next week or so. Yeah, something like that. Yep. Yeah.
Gonna get that business.
I also think it's pretty cool that, like, and I know we've gone over this, we don't need to beat on Rogue One or anything, but like I actually felt encouraged, and the more I've watched that movie, and it has, or not watched that movie, the more I've thought about that movie, it's encouraging to think that like these external stories that they're letting these directors kind of do can stand alone and kind of be their own pieces. And obviously, you know, like Han Solo movie is not going to be, you know, everybody's not going to die at the end of that one or anything like that, but it could still be an encapsulated story, and it doesn't necessarily have to be like, well, this is going to happen here and this happens next, and then this is this, like maybe they get to do that with all of these. And that's at least mildly more encouraging to me, because when I first heard like Han Solo and the other one's Boba Fett, right?
Yeah.
When I first heard that, I was kind of like, oh, we're going to get like prequels. I don't know if I want a prequel kind of thing, but we'll see.
The universe is just so fun to explore. And that's one of the things when I'm talking about Rebels in a little bit, I just, there's some things I can't wait to touch on just because we'll get there. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Next is just a very short story. And I don't know if you guys have seen this yet, but it was such a cool kind of happy story that I felt like sharing it with listeners. It kind of broke last week, but people were looking at the credits for Zelda Breath of the Wild, and there are very few, like I think only maybe two or three Western names in there. The rest are obviously Japanese developers, and, you know, a huge Japanese team worked on Breath of the Wild. And someone saw the name of Corey Bunnell in there and was like, Corey Bunnell, like that name does not match up. One of these things is not like the others.
Yeah, sure.
And someone did some internet sleuthing to see like who the heck this guy is, because he's literally just surrounded by a sea of hundreds and hundreds of other Japanese names. And someone did some digging and found an old blog post from 2007 from this guy, Corey Bunnell. And the blog post said, my dream is to live in Japan and work for Nintendo as a game designer. And this is a blog post from high school. It says, my dream is to live in Japan and work for Nintendo as a game designer. I realize this is a very large goal, but it has been my dream since I first played Mario. And to make a long story short, he ended up going to Japan and working in Japan and kind of getting his visa there, and ended up getting hired by Nintendo in 2014 and worked on Breath of the Wild as a wildlife programmer. So he worked on a lot of the animals and stuff that you encounter.
Interesting.
And I just thought that was really cool that a decade ago he set out to, you know, work at this developer that, you know, of course does hire Western talent, but not all that often. So I thought that was just spectacular that this Corey guy, Corey Bunnell, pulled it off and ends up working on, you know, Zelda out of nowhere.
That's amazing. I have a fun story related to this. When I was a kid, I was obviously super into Mega Man 2, as a lot of people were. And I read Nintendo Power at the time. And so, you know, and I would always like flip through the magazines and read about all the characters and stuff like that. I designed my own Mega Man characters, you know, like when I was a kid, I'd draw them on paper and color them in with colored pencils and stuff. I made I made a Mega Man boss called, like, I think I called him like Nintendo Man, and it was basically like his hands were like Nintendo controllers and light zappers and stuff like that, and he was basically just made up of Nintendo parts.
Nice.
And I think I actually, with, you know, my parents' help, I mailed it to Nintendo, and I got a letter back from them saying like, hey, thanks for your submission, but I've, you know, of course we can't accept any, you know, ideas or whatever. So they said, I just thought it was amazing that I like sent it in and they sent me a letter back. Like,
that is really neat.
Thanking me.
That's really neat.
I can't remember if I sent it to like Nintendo Power or if I sent it to Nintendo, you know, but, yeah, I totally understand the dream that this person had. And it's awesome that,
you pulled it off. I mean, it took him quite a bit, but he did it. So
yeah, I'm gonna have to dig up those drawings. Maybe I'll share those with people if I can.
Yeah, find them. I want to see them for sure.
Cause I remember doodle a lot.
Good.
Oh no. Yeah. Yeah.
I was going to make a joke anyways. I remember back in the day I was watching, you know, softcore, Showtime channel stuff and thought, man, one day, no,
I really
will make love to a woman.
I actually really like the setup for this joke, and I'm sorry that I interrupted it, but
no, I interrupted you. It wasn't worth it.
No, it's totally worth it. That was totally worth it. Cause it's hilarious.
Let's get down and dirty, guys. Don't you guys just miss Cinemax now and again?
Do I miss it?
I wouldn't say I miss it, Ash.
Do you miss watching Scrambled Cinemax and like just praying that you'd see like a butt cheek or just something?
Man, that's...
It was never scrambled for me. My parents didn't understand what cable was, so we had everything on cable. We had HBO, Showtime, Cinemax. That wasn't actually a total lie. I had like all those movies and everything, but
I do remember.
The thing is, like, I remember growing up and like I watched a lot more bad movies than I did like the softcore cable movie stuff.
Like, you would like, just watch,
like, I watched
on
a lot of like bad horror movies. Yeah, whatever was just, yeah, like that's why I know like what you know, I don't know, Escape from New York and all those movies, like that was from watching it on HBO because it would just play it endlessly.
Yeah,
that's true. They did replay a lot of stuff.
And it's funny you brought that up, Ash. Like, I feel like we're really showing our age, and that, you know, sometimes you see a list of things. It's like, oh, things that you won't be able to explain to like a generation after you. And one of those things is like scrambled cable channels. You know what I mean?
That's true. It doesn't really exist anymore.
Yeah, like I remember when you know, I used to be big into like pro wrestling, right? And so like a lot of those events would air on pay-per-view, and you want to know what happens because it's like a serialized drama. So I sometimes would just put on the scrambled channel just so I can listen to the commentary so that I know what happened, you know, in the
yeah, because the audio wasn't scrambled, and then the image would come through like every 30 seconds. You'd get like a solid frame of the action, you know.
It would blink in, so I'd be watching like SummerSlam on Scramble Vision, but listening to like Jerry the King Lawler like call it out, so I knew what happened. So when I went to school or whatever the next day, I'd be like, yeah, and then, you know, Ultimate Warrior did this and that, and it's like, really,
you know,
takes
what's crazy though. Hmm. Like, pay-per-view is still a big thing, like boxing and MMA and wrestling and all that still does pay-per-view, and it's still giant. Like, it still makes millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's surprising. But I mean,
that's crazy.
I guess live, you know, live sports is always kind of like that golden.
That's the thing.
That golden thing, you know, like that everybody wants because it's so time sensitive, right? I think that's why you're still able to get people to pay for something like that because of the, you know. And that's always been the hitch with like streaming TV too, is that like, I think that was a showstopper for a lot of folks when cutting the cord started to like get its legs, because people still wanted access to live sports. And of course now you have that, but I don't know how we got here, but
I think right.
was it softcore Cinemax? Is that how we got here?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. Ash wanted to know if we were into it.
Oh
yeah.
Okay.
just curious.
Yeah.
Did I ever tell you guys Did I ever tell you guys the story about the guy who would come into the video store and rent Cinemax movies?
You may have. I don't remember exactly.
I don't think so.
I worked at a video store for a few years. I worked at it in high school, but I worked at a different one after high school. And the one that I worked at after high school had like actual pornography in it. Like, you could rent, you go back to this room and flip through a binder and rent like real hardcore pornography. And but we had this guy who came in, this nice older gentleman, who would come in and every Friday would rent five like softcore Cinemax style porns that were like edited and stuff, you know, and would rent 5 of them. Every Sunday he would come back, return them all fully rewound and everything. But it's just wow. Every week.
Wow.
He showed up every week and checked out 5 new. And they were always like, you know, it was like the titles were like ridiculous. It was just like the, oh God, I can't even think of a good one. Like the something agency. Like it was always just like weird. Like they would try to veil it in drama, you know, or yes. Thriller or like something. It was always like, yeah, like there was like a thriller or a drama narrative around this weird softcore cable porn. It was very weird. But yeah, the guy checked out 5 every week because that was the limit. You could check out 5 movies at a time. Also, video stores, guys. Come on. We're aging ourselves.
I was going to say, yeah, video stores.
They were awesome. They were like, I loved them as a kid. They were my favorite place to go.
I liked working there. Scott and Adam and Andrew and my friends would come in. I would work during the week. They would come in on Friday and rent 5 terrible horror movies, and then we would watch them over the weekend.
We'd get anime too, occasionally.
Anime, yeah, because it was all free, so we would just check out whatever I could get my hands on.
Good times.
Well, video stores, man. Now it's Netflix. Kids don't know what it's like anymore.
Oh, kids.
Yeah, those late charges were just wonderful, let me tell you.
Hey, you're paying it. You don't even know you're paying it now.
That's true. I don't know that I'm paying that. So we are back with some reviews, and I'm going to talk as spoiler-free as possible about the Star Wars Rebels Season 3 episode Twin Suns, which was sort of the big episode they've been building to in the season. I know you guys aren't quite caught up yet, so I'll try and be sort of vague, but at the same time, I do just kind of want to explain how freaking awesome this episode was. So they're in this weird place in Rebels now where I was almost 100% positive that this had to be the last season, because where they're currently at is maybe 6 months perhaps before Rogue One,
which
about 6 months, 7 months before Episode 4. And you know that really Rebels, I mean, I guess technically it could continue post, you know, post original trilogy, but I just didn't see it, you know, moving into Episode 4, 5, and 6. I think that would be really odd.
Yeah.
Considering also, you know, there are multiple Jedi on the show, and that would just be really weird. So Twin Suns takes place, I want to say 6 or 7 months before the events of Rogue One. And so what ends up happening is, you know, if you've been watching Clone Wars at all over the past several years, you know that Darth Maul is back, and Darth Maul does continue all the way up into Rebels. And so this is a Darth Maul and Obi-Wan Kenobi episode.
Oh,
but
my gosh.
But the thing that makes Twin Suns spectacular is it takes place on Tatooine. And it takes place on Tatooine right before the events of Episode 4. So you get to see old Ben, you know, sort of in his old Ben glory. And you get to see him interacting with certain members of the Ghost crew. And this is all canonical now, so it's really interesting to know that, you know, Ben Kenobi does know in the new canon that there are other people that are Force wielders in the world, and that, you know, that Luke Skywalker is not the last Jedi, really, at the time, that there are others out there.
There's a nice title drop there, by the way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
but it is a pretty amazing confrontation between Darth Maul and old Ben Kenobi. I'm not going to tell you the result of it, but it is it does some really great things visually, that it harkens back to the original fight that they had in The Phantom Menace.
It's kind of weird to think that, like, all of a sudden, like, that Darth Maul is his nemesis now. You know what I mean?
Right. Yeah. Because you wouldn't really think that. But if you look at the history of the characters now, especially with the new canon, and you look at Clone Wars and you look at the things that Maul does to Kenobi over the course of that series, the Clone Wars, and it is really like Darth Maul is Obi-Wan Kenobi's ultimate nemesis, not Darth Vader. Like Darth Vader, like he, you know, I think he has, I truly feel like he is sorry for what he did.
You are my brother Anakin.
Yeah, I mean, he is just like, he is still not over the fact that he had to do what he did. And let's be honest, like what he did to Anakin was pretty dark. I mean,
don't you think that there's a bit of like, so Darth Maul created Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan in essence created Darth Vader, right? So like,
right,
sure. Darth Maul in killing Obi-Wan's mentor and basically like hunting him for years.
Right.
That's kind a good of point.
made him the sort of like, I don't know, I feel like Obi-Wan was less programmed by the Jedi than other Jedi, if that makes sense.
Yeah, he was always kind of he always thought outside the box as a Jedi Master, right? If you watch Clone Wars, he was always the one who kind of questioned everything and was a bit roguish. Like he had an affair when he wasn't supposed to. He had like love in his life, which he wasn't supposed to have. So there's a lot of things about Kenobi that I think make him, you know, one of the most spectacular Star Wars characters. And a lot of that was established, of course, in the Clone Wars, which if you haven't watched, I think it's like it's going off Netflix soon.
Is it really?
Yeah, wow. It is. They're losing their contract. So
I think we're like four episodes from finishing it. It was very good.
Yeah, it's really, really good. Other quick things, I just want to talk about the Twin Suns episode. You know, Rebels season 3 has been by far the standout season. I feel like they got a big, big boost in their animation budget. And so one of the things you'll notice if you go from Clone Wars, straight from Clone Wars, like I did, to watching Rebels, you'll notice that the style of animation changes to be like more representative of Ralph McQuarrie's art, but it also kind of loses a little bit of the fidelity. And that kind of always bummed me out because Clone Wars, the last couple seasons were just like unbelievably gorgeous. They just were just really, really pretty. And they were costing, I think, a little bit over $1 million an episode, which is why they kind of bumped the budget down for Rebels. But as of season 3 right now, Rebels is kind of every episode, it gets better and better and better. So it's really, really pretty to look at. I feel like the Lucasfilm Star Wars Story Group, as they're called, is really, really going to great lengths to create a fully fleshed out universe that across all media. So comic books, Rebels, the movies, and it's all actually weaving together very well now. Whereas at the beginning of Rebels, I don't think that was necessarily the case. I think it was kind of standing on its own and doing its own thing. Now they're bringing in really cool tertiary characters like Wedge Antilles and you know, Ahsoka Tano, and like all these characters that exist in the universe that you just always wanted to know a little bit more about. And Rebels has those characters now. So it's spectacular. It's getting better and better all the time. And they're doing things like revitalizing old characters from the old canon, like Thrawn, who was a fan favorite of mine as a kid, you know, reading the old Timothy Zahn books.
I think there's a new book coming out for him soon.
Yeah, and he's incredible. He's like this just super, super tactical genius. But, you know, he's in the series now, and they're going to have like this big space battle with him, I think, next week. So check it out. Catch up on Rebels, watch it. Season 3 spectacular, and keep your eyes peeled for the episode Twin Suns, and let us know what you think about the Kenobi Maul fight.
Nice. Yeah, that's
good stuff.
That's awesome. That's for me. I know like a lot of people are down on the prequel trilogy, but for me, like the prequel trilogy is really a story about Obi-Wan, right? And so that kind of like that kind of like saves a lot of it for me, is when you think about it, it's really not about Anakin, it's about Obi-Wan. So anytime we get something new for him is great. And anytime you bring up Darth Maul, I always want to bring up a book which is now in the legacy, right? Because it came out in 2001. But there was a really early book called Darth Maul Shadow Hunter, which is like, it's like really awesome because it's like a thriller with Darth Maul as like the, you know, the guy that's doing all the thrilling, if you will. So if you're looking for something interesting, it's kind of like a, you know, the book kind of stands on its own or whatever, but it really just kind of provides a lot of depth into his character and who he is and how he acts. And it's like the, I think the first time I ever read a book that was not, you know, about the main characters and extending that canon at the time.
Right.
So it's
his story in Clone Wars is fantastic. Like,
yeah,
what they do with him and, what's it, S name? His brother.
Oh, yeah. I don't remember his
Savage. Savage. Yeah. Savage.
Yes. Yeah,
Savage Opress.
Yeah. Right? I always thought that was really great and unexpected, I think, which was what was great about it. It was just like showing how they get created and all that kind of stuff was pretty amazing.
Loved it.
Yeah. All right. So the next thing I want to talk about is a game that's available for mobile. It's actually an interactive fiction novel. But it's from something that Matt and I really love, which is White Wolf, who is, sort of they own the world of darkness, which includes, you know, Vampire the Masquerade, Werewolf the Apocalypse, and Mage the Ascension. And, it sounds like maybe White Wolf is poised for something of a comeback, because they're starting out with two, interactive fiction books, which is, one I didn't look at, which is Mage the Ascension Refuge, and one that I did look at, which is called Vampire the Masquerade, We Eat Blood and All of Our Friends Are Dead, which is like a great title for, yeah, I know, right? But it's so being an interactive book, you know, you kind of do a lot of reading and there's some player choice involved when you respond to different dialogue options and stuff, but it basically turns your phone into a chat app almost, and so the whole story is told through you talking to, you know, texting with people on your phone, like your friends and people you don't know and like strangers and stuff like that. So it's got a really really great art style. So like it's some of the art reminds me of like some maybe like off the wall like comic book style. So it's not just, you know, you're not just looking at it like a chat interface. It's got like a lot of art. The main character in this book is like an artist. So like he'll be talking to another character and he'll be like, I drew a picture of it, and you'll see the picture. And it's like, oh, cool. It's like it's a lot of good stuff like that too. But it basically follows the story of two people who slowly realize that they have become vampires. And so they're kind of just dealing nice. With dealing with what that's like and being in the world of darkness. It's kind of got like a very heavy tone to it. And, it's broken up into like, I think 5 or 6 different chapters. And so you're kind of like inside the mind of this main character, Case, who is, artistic, which makes me think he's probably like a toreador. If you're into the Vampire the Masquerade kind of thing, or maybe he's kind of like heading in that direction, if you will. And then he starts to get, you know, he's talking to, I think his friend or his sister, Izzy, and they're kind of just both figuring out together like what's happening to the two of them. And then meanwhile he starts to get messages from this like weird character called Mother, and they don't know who this person is. And it's like a big you know, a big story woven through all these different conversations, and as this person like travels around trying to figure out like what to do with themselves. So it's really fascinating. And the thing that's like got me most excited is just that I feel like there hasn't been any, you know, really like digital products from, you know, within the vampire line since the, you know, the game, which was, what was that called? Bloodlines, the good one.
Yeah.
The one Bloodlines. That they're like the kind of like the cult favorite. But I mean, what in White Wolf isn't, you know, has a cult following? That's kind of like the shtick, right? Is that either you're like kind of into that stuff or you're not. But I really hope that, you know, seeing these visual novels come out is maybe a sign that more stuff is on the way. But both books are available now for Steam, Android, and iOS. The Vampire interactive fiction game is written and illustrated by Zach Sabbath, and Sarah Horrocks is the names on that. For those people that are Mage fans, there's also a Mage the Ascension visual novel called Refuge, which was, I think, authored by Karen Tidbeck, which is a Swedish author. So, go ahead and check them out. And I really don't know. I know we talk about, you know, being fans of the White Wolf properties, but I don't really know if a lot of people in our listening circle are into that. So let us know, because Matt and I played like a ton of Vampire. Yeah. And we owned a lot of those books too. And we even dabbled in the Werewolf Apocalypse card game, which had some really awesome card art. So I just seeing stuff like this gets me excited and reminds me of stuff that like we did.
Do you know what past guest of ours was also a huge fan of? Do you remember this from this is a long time ago.
I don't. You'll have to remind me.
I believe I do. I remember talking to somebody about it.
It was Jessica Chobot used to play.
Really?
In high school. Really? Yeah. She was a big Vampire of the Masquerade.
Yeah. Fan. That's awesome. I mean, I feel like I probably own almost the complete set of the original Vampire. What was that game? The Eternal Struggle is like kind of the revised name of the game, if you will.
You used to own it. I have them now. Everybody gave them to me.
No, I still have mine. I didn't give you my cards.
What? Why do I have so many then?
I mean, maybe you got cards from the other two guys, but I still have all of mine, so we can like.
So I have a hint as to why you may be seeing such new stuff popping up from them right
sure.
now.
Sure. Why is that?
They got bought a year and a half ago by Paradox Interactive.
Oh, who does okay.
Magicka and Pillars of Eternity and all
nice.
That.
Nice. Okay. Good.
So maybe they bought the IP to start churning out some games inside of it.
That's super exciting. I would love to see this revitalized in whatever. You know, any format.
I still, you know, I know we're both waiting for it, but I still think Werewolf could make for a really good setting for different type, like a bunch of different types of games. I feel like they could really do a lot with that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, because I feel like that kind of came and went and maybe was overshadowed by Vampire and...
Yeah.
I always forget the last one. What is it? Wraith is the fourth one?
Well, there was Mage, yeah, and Wraith, yeah.
Yeah, Mage,
and there Vampire. Was a Fairy one that came out. They kind of overcrowded the market for a little bit.
Oh,
but,
I gotcha. I feel like the Vampire big ones is the
Mage,
core. Yeah.
Mage, Werewolf, and Vampire. Those are the big three.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm kind of just even interested to know if anybody in our listening community like was really into that stuff back in the day, because like we certainly were. I didn't have as many books as you guys did. I think I just have like two or three, but damn, those cards, man. Like I'd play that game any day, and I feel like I still remember how to do it. So it's exciting stuff. Yeah.
Love it.
Yeah.
Cool. So next up is sort of a mini review. I did not have a ton of time to play anything this week. I've been traveling since PAX. But a thing that I thought was funny, because I talked to Ash about this show at PAX and how much I disliked the initial pilot for season one, and that is Love on Netflix, which is Paul Rust and Gillian Jacobs. Gillian's from Community. Paul Rust is from Comedy Bang Bang, if you're a fan of that podcast, and I think he was on the show as well. And he was a writer for the show, for sure. And stars Claudia Doherty as well, and a bunch of other kind of people show up. Andy Dixon, it. Carrie Kenny from, is that her last name? From The State?
From The State.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yep, in Reno. And then it's executive produced by Judd Apatow, who apparently had a big hand in it. Yeah, so basically the story is about these two kind of question mark millennials. I think they're like towards the end of their 20s into their early 30s. And they're kind of lost in LA. They both are kind of meandering through their jobs and their lives. They both go through some breakups early on in season one. And then season one kind of follows them into them becoming an item at the end of it. Season two picks up basically right there and kind of moves forward with this story about, you know, how well these two can be in a relationship together. I don't think they ever say they love each other through the entire thing. And you find out in season two that both seasons have taken place over 4 weeks of actual time.
Oh my gosh.
In writing. So it's not as if you're watching like years of relationship happen.
That's wild.
It's over a very short period. What I wanted to say about it is that it was around episode 5 of season 1 that it really took a turning point for me, and I actually started enjoying the show and like watching it because I liked it and not just because it was on kind of thing. There were a few good moments in it where I found myself chuckling a little, and I kind of got over some of my I'm not a huge Paul Rust fan, I guess is the easiest way to put it. So it kind of turned me off at the beginning of the show is one of it. I will say that Claudia Doherty, who plays Gillian Jacobs' roommate, is
she's
probably
great.
One of the secret treasures of the show. Every moment that she's in it is like absolutely wonderful. The stuff she says is incredible, like, and funny and engaging, and like her character is just kind of feels very real, where whereas because she starts, so in season one you don't see a lot of her and she's kind of cartoony, she kind of just shows up and has like a funny line or two and then she kind of disappears again. In season two she starts to get some real depth. She starts having real reactions with Gillian's character when they're talking. She starts having her own relationship issues and her own things that are going on in her life, and it's kind of interesting to see them open that character up more. And I wouldn't be shocked if it's because they got a lot of probably good feedback on her in season one. But you do also start to get a more realistic version of Paul Rust and Gillian Jacobs' characters as well. It really starts playing more real and less of this kind of heightened, you know, ironic sense of what a relationship is, I guess, mm-hmm. in modern day society. I've already finished season one. It came out, I think, a week ago, or season two rather. It came out a week ago. It's done well. There are some moments that you probably dislike just because they get a little long, but I feel like, I don't know if you guys feel like this, Netflix shows, you know, you would lump this in with Master of None or Girls from HBO, or it sits right in that genre of kind of real Louis, you know, those kind of like real life comedy shows. Very Judd Apatowian. But
is that a word you just made up?
Oh yeah.
Apatowian? Yeah.
Yeah. Like no. he clearly has like a,
there's a formula.
A formula, yeah. And these shows are all following them pretty closely. Crashing's another one on HBO from Pete Holmes. The Netflix ones run 13 episodes. All of them do. And I really feel like they should be 10. I don't know if you guys feel that way as well, but I'm including the Marvel shows. I felt that way about
Daredevil as well. Yeah.
Yeah. All of them tend to have like two episodes that you can tell they're just like stretching. They're just like, well, we got to get these two extra episodes. They all feel like they could be trimmed a little bit, and it would hew closer to what HBO's are all, I think, 10 or 11 episodes.
Yeah.
And they tend to be tighter seasons that feel, I don't know what it is about that number, but that number just seems to work a little better. And Love season two kind of falls into that trap a little. There's a couple episodes where you're just like, just let's move it along kind of thing. But overall, I really enjoyed it. And surprisingly, because I did not enjoy the beginning of season one a whole lot, and then slowly kind of started liking it. And season two felt a little bit tighter and a little more kind of focused on the different characters that are there and less worried about telling one specific love
story. Is Maude Apatow in season two?
She is, but much less.
Oh, bummer. She was like my favorite in the first season.
Oh, really? I like her. Like, I've liked her in the movies that she's done. Like, this.
Right.
I think she's really great. I can't tell if it's her character or her acting in this show that.
Oh, really?
Not a fan. Yeah. One of the two. It was a very, like, she has some really great parts in the second season. Much more like, I don't know, she's very moment to moment, I guess, for me. Like, there are certain moments where you're like, oh, that was so great. Like, she has a great line and she delivers it kind of like the perfect 12-year-old or whatever she's supposed to be.
Right.
Like, it sits and like fits very real. And then sometimes it's just like listening to a 12-year-old and you're like, oh, I don't, you know, what am I listening to right now? So I guess that's kind of where I felt about it. But yeah, she's back in. Everybody, I want to say pretty much everyone's back. I don't know of anybody that kind of disappeared. I mean, you'd have to figure it if it only takes place over a month.
Right.
You know, yeah, people don't come and go out of people's lives that quickly.
It's crazy.
So if you haven't ever watched any of Love, because I know Master of None kind of had a bigger buzz about it than Love ever did.
Yeah.
If you never watched any of it, I'd recommend watching it, but just know that the first few episodes of season one, you may be like, what am I watching? And then it'll kind of click in and pick up.
Yeah, it's a little dark.
It's a little depressing in the beginning. Yeah, it's definitely darker. They deal with very heavy issues of addiction but they deal with them, but not super in depth. So it's not like, you're not going to get like head shrunk by watching it, but you will at least get maybe a little bit of that kind of emotion out of it.
Yeah, I just kind of got the vibe that everyone on the show smelled kind of bad. That's like what I left. That's the taste that season one left in my mouth. Like, everyone probably smells.
It's very LA. Very
visceral, yeah.
LA hipster millennial. Very that. And it's weirdly also sort of like Master of None was kind of a story about you know, they always kind of say it's about New York. Like, New York's one of the characters. And I would say this show feels very L.A. while you're watching it. Like, it's clearly set in L.A. and is very, like, there's L.A. locations and stuff. Even from my few visits that I've done, it, like, I noticed, I recognize places that are in Echo Park and all these kind of hipstery areas. So, you know, if you want to feel like you're in the sunshine, you can watch that. It's a nice little break from the wintry blues. Mm. So, but yeah, it was pretty good. I recommend it. I guess I've turned around on it, because I wouldn't, if this was just season one, and I don't think I did review it on the show, I would have never even talked about it, because I did not super enjoy the first half. But
interesting.
Once I kind of sat down and got through it, I was like, oh, okay, I get it. I'm with it now. So,
but there you stuck go. Around.
Yeah.
Let's see. I can issue a correction to my earlier posts before we move on.
No, I don't think so.
Well, it's not a correction, as it is more information. Regarding the White Wolf franchise, this may be interesting to you, Matt.
Sure.
White Wolf is working on a fifth edition of Vampire the Masquerade tabletop RPG books and recently announced a video game adaptation of Werewolf the Apocalypse.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so your wish is granted, my friend.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it. We used to play that card game in middle school, like at school.
Yeah, it was just, I feel like we spent so much money on the vampire game that we never really got to collect a lot of those cards, but they were really nice because they were all glossy and had,
and
like,
they were super
like really nice thick cardstock too, which is like surprising for a card game. But
I also want to say that Werewolf.
Breaking news.
I want to say Werewolf.
Breaking news.
Breaking news. The Werewolf the Apocalypse game is a match 3 game with werewolf shaped gems.
Are you serious?
Are you serious?
No, I'm not.
Oh, Jesus. Don't scare me like that.
Sorry, guys.
Siri just answered me, guys. I said, are you serious? And it chimed in and then said, I'm always serious.
Whoa.
Anyways,
it's sad that
I want to say Werewolf was the only tabletop one. I mean, we played like a little bit of Vampire, but I want to say we played a decent amount of Werewolf.
I feel like it was easier to wrap your head around regarding what it was. But it's funny that Ash can say that, and it's like so believable now in this day and age that you're like, sure, why wouldn't it be?
You are listening to the Rated NA podcast at nerdappropriate.com.
We are going to be talking about the Mass Effect 10-hour trial that you could get through EA Access or Origin Access. I think both Scott and I played the Xbox One versions and the PC versions.
Yep. Just for reference, it's Monday night, so we're just kind of like killing time until the game unlocks is what we're really doing.
Yeah, which is like any hour now, so we're... Yeah, I might even stay up tonight and play for a bit.
I know you just will. Because
I probably will.
You will.
But so this is interesting. So I guess we should say that we're not really reviewing the game. We're just going to give impressions of the 10-hour trial and stuff we liked and maybe some stuff that we didn't like. And then we have our quick question of the week. I fired off this afternoon about people that played the trial. What did you like or what did you not like? But I'll start off by saying there were a couple of things that really stood out to me as great. I really did enjoy the combat this time around. Mm-hmm. And I really noticed when playing with headphones, like how great the audio is this time around. The ambience and the sound of the weapons was really, really fantastic. So if you are a person that plays, with solid headphones, definitely like listen closely to the sound of the gunfire. I don't know if they like perhaps rated dice for some of their sound effects, but the weapons just sound absolutely fantastic.
As far as audio goes, can we just, you listen for the sound of the weapons. I listen a lot to the music, So like, I've not gotten tired of hearing that kind of like sound effect that's in the score of the game where it's like that noise that you hear, like it's on the title screen, so you won't miss it. But like, I hear it throughout the game in different places. And, I love that sound effect. I'm like totally stoked on it.
Yeah, it's good. And I don't know why that was the first thing that stood out to me, but I'm obviously going super spoiler free and I don't want to get too much into plot and stuff like that. Other standout stuff, initially when we played the multiplayer at PAX, I was not a fan of the new jump packs and stuff. I wasn't really into it.
Mm-hmm.
But after playing it for many, many hours now, I like the jetpack and I like the dash ability. Especially now that I figured out exactly like how to hover in flight and fire from fire mid flight.
Yes.
Which is really great. I mean, you can do some great flanks and you can fire off your powers from midair too. So if you're like a Vanguard, you can charge from midair. You can actually charge enemies. I didn't do this myself, but you can use a throw and throw an enemy into the sky and then charge the enemy like up straight up into the air, right?
Yeah.
And tag them while they're in the air, and then you'll be like a mile up, and then you can aim down and do like one of the flying punches.
Oh, just a melee, just a basic melee, right?
There's a lot of variety now with combat that I think didn't exist before, especially since you can mix and match builds, which is totally new. I mean, they have new player profiles, so you can like take, you know, a skill from a tech skill and then match it up with a biotic skill and match it up with a soldier skill, and then that can be the build that you make. So you can get very creative and really come up with combos that I can't even fathom like what people are going to come up with in terms of, you know, their own special builds. I think that, you know, people will find the craziest things. So
yeah.
What did you end up experimenting with, Scott?
Let's see. So I played in multiplayer. I think right off the bat in multiplayer, you get to unlock some loyalty packs for playing like Mass Effect 3 and Dragon Age. And I'm sure a lot of our listeners, will see the same stuff pop up in their profile. So, I got access to the Krogan Vanguard, which is Vanguard is like my bread and butter. It's what I've played through in all of the Mass Effect games on my first playthrough. So I think the sort of the three-dimensional aspect of the combat in this game really kind of like spoke to me for the reason that you identified earlier, which is the fact that you can do things like leap into the air and then charge down at somebody. So just having that third dimension to fight in really kind of opens up the combat because it's kind of a buzzkill, right? When the enemies are standing behind cover and you're behind cover and it's like, who's going to shoot first, who's going to move first, that kind of thing. And now that doesn't really matter as much because you can just kind of jump out and fight and maneuver around very quickly. So I feel like once you start taking your eyes off the ground and looking up into the sky, you also start to notice like, oh, I can go in that building. Oh, I can get on top of that building. Right. So now you're kind of like thinking a little bit deeper into your strategies and stuff like that. So for me, I'm super stoked. And once you get the hang of like the fact that you can kind of like jump and then dash or jump and then hover and dash and stuff like that, I really think that people are going to be super stoked on that. As I am wont to do these days, I started my playthrough on Insanity because I don't know. I just kind of enjoy the challenge of that in the game. And so I like the idea that you can take, that you can kind of do your build on the fly, because I really feel like when you're starting out, it's really important to have things like overload and incinerate so that you can deal with armor so that your teammates can like take out the enemies when they become squishy. Right.
Right.
So, I'm rolling with that, but I hate being locked. You know, I previously would have hated being locked into the fact that I'm basically building a sentinel. Right. And, now I know that I can build that sentinel. And once I get a lot of experience points, I can switch into doing other things like becoming like a Vanguard again. Right. As I go through my playthrough. So, you know,
or I think, a combo of both, right?
Yeah.
Like overload and charge. Like, why not?
Exactly. And the thing that you were kind of getting to is the fact that you have these like combat profiles now so that you can take all of the abilities that you've unlocked and create different sets of three. And then those sets of three kind of pair with these like archetypes, which basically just grant you bonuses, right? So if you unlock enough skill points to unlock the adept archetype, then you can, you know, assign that to your, whatever your quick set is. And then you get those bonuses, right? So you get your bonus, like biotic damage and your recharge time and stuff like that. So, I really think that there are opportunities for synergies in the system, which is exciting. Or if you just kind of want to do a little bit of everything, the game will allow you to do that too. And there's even an archetype for like this kind of like, three headed class, because in the past they've always had, you know, six.
I think it was called Explorer.
It's
now,
Explorer.
I think it is.
Yeah. So, like, in the past, there have only been like six classes, which are like, you know, one and then combinations of two, and now there's one for all three, which is called Explore. So if you want to take one of everything, you can. So I think that will encourage people to experiment outside of their comfort zone. I think that might help people who are coming to this game as first-person shooter fans to kind of experiment a little bit more. Because I do remember around the time of Mass Effect 2 or 3, they released some data regarding what most people played as, and like surprisingly or not surprisingly, a lot of people still played as Soldier, right? Which is kind of the I don't want to say it's like vanilla, but it's kind of very traditional, I guess, as far as the playstyle goes.
Right.
So I think now if those you know, FPS fans come to the game and they go, well, I'm going to take you know, Concussion Shot and like Adrenaline Rush or whatever, like maybe they'll go, oh, let me try Pull too. And the next thing you know, you do Pull and then use your Concussion Shot and you're like, okay, now I really see like what's happening here with the combat. So I'm just kind of excited. And maybe the last thing I'll add is I was always a big fan of the Mako in the original game, and I like the new vehicle. And a lot of stuff in this game really does remind me of Mass Effect 1, both from a gameplay mechanic standpoint as well as the sort of the larger gameplay, which is like exploring planets and collecting resources and stuff like that. I kind of feel like this is what Mass Effect 1 would have been if it were made today, you know, because I see a lot of that DNA in this game.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, there are some like minor qualms, and you know, the game has kind of come under fire for some of its animations. And, you know, I'll just talk about it briefly, but, you know, all of the big news sites have kind of touched on it already, so I don't feel like beating a dead horse. But some of them seem incomplete. Some of them seem like perhaps they were rushed. And I don't know what happened, and I don't know why, you know, some of them look the way they do. But it seems like a lot of the alien races, their animation's done, and like Krogans, things of that nature. But some of the human animation is a little odd. And Matt mentioned earlier, he's like, it's very uncanny valley, like faces doing things that faces shouldn't do, right? Like non-human stretching and eyes looking the way they shouldn't look, and things that basically just seemed like there probably was a polished pass or two that didn't quite reach the team in time, you know? So that's, you know, that's something that you as a player are going to have to kind of get over at this point, because it's not going to be patched day one. So it happened. I honestly started the trial so early. I built a character, quickly jumped in and played. I played for like 5 minutes, and I was like, oh, like my face is weird. So I restarted. I restarted twice because I kept getting to parts and I was like, why is my character making that face?
Yeah.
And it turns out like, that's just what it does. Like, there was no me like fixing my character to make it like not make that weird face. So I ended up going with, the default Sarah, who, I think is a little better, at least for me to kind of, to look at.
Yeah, sure.
And there's also some stuff you can do, you can actually, when you're out in combat and you have encounters with other NPCs and such, you can have your helmet on so you don't see faces at all. And
I mean, it's a very small aspect of a very large game, right? I mean, it's certainly, we can talk about it, but like you said, there's ways to just kind of enjoy the other parts of the game if that's weirding you out, you know?
Right. And that's the thing. Like I
feel like I don't in a month, this will be much ado about nothing, you know?
No, I totally agree. Yeah. And I don't think like this is really an issue at all. I don't think it's really going to detract from my experience with the game, but I do feel like it is something that, you know, I noticed, and I did have to restart the game because of it. So I thought I should, you know, at least bring it up, but you know, I don't think it's a huge deal. In terms of the narrative, I'm excited. Like I got to the point in the trial, I played through the trial, I think 3 times total. Mm-hmm. And I got to the point in the trial where I couldn't go on anymore, and I'm really interested in seeing what happens next. I think the characters I've been introduced to so far are really interesting. I think the armor sets and like the weapons look gorgeous, so I'm just interested in unlocking more and in tweaking out my character and doing all those fun RPG things. So that's, you know, that's what's in terms of the plot. You know, It's early. So I don't know. Like I'm drawn in. I'm not like doing backflips over the things I've experienced, but I think it's definitely interesting enough to continue on, you know. I'm like not bored by it. I just I'm just very intrigued about exploring the rest of the universe. I think what got me where I was like, oh hell yeah, well, there's a point, and this is not really a spoiler, but you're driving around in the new Nomad, is that what it's called?
Yes.
Driving around in the Nomad, and I found like what looked like to be a blown up camp. And you can get out and you can scan stuff now for information. And I'm getting out and I'm scanning, and I found a body and like a little data pad. And I found this corpse, and there's info on the data pad. And then the characters that I was with started having conversation about the body, and the AI that's in my character's head started talking to me about the guy that was there dead. And I'm like, oh, if there's like all this stuff to discover out in the wild,
yes,
and it's all has like stuff that your characters are going to talk about and your companions are going to talk about, and there's just this vast universe to explore, I'm like, holy cow, like this is going to be a hell of an experience, you know?
Yeah.
Just all these little things that, and even just the act of scanning, I think to me is exciting because I get to learn more about all these little things, you know, as I'm exploring.
Yeah. I mean, the thing that is, like for me, like it's all about exploration, right? And the thing that I keep going back to is, you know, in Mass Effect 1, like, yes, there were a lot of planets you would drive around. There wasn't a lot to see because I'm sure the technology was limited in what you could do as far as like driving around a planet goes. But there were still things for you to find out there. And occasionally you would find something in the world that would make you think. And the thing that I keep thinking about is in Mass Effect 1, there's like this one planet, I think it might be Pharos, where you drive to the corner of the map and you just, there's like this like Prothean orb that's like floating, and you walk up and touch the orb. And I don't think it's really critical to the story or anything, but it, there's this whole page of text that appears that kind of describes to you in like a DM kind of way, like what happened to you when you touched the orb.
I do. I remember that.
Yeah. And it's like, now we're in a place where you don't just have to put up a page of text to explain what happened when you touched the orb. Like there are probably things in this game where if you travel off the beaten path enough that you'll find crazy things, like little weird side notes, like bizarre puzzles and like little riddles and Easter eggs that are probably scattered all throughout this game. And so I'm just excited to get out and find this. I feel like this is the game that like I wanted to see when like I was still enjoying Mass Effect 3, but I was like, I feel like we've kind of gotten away from what was exciting about Mass Effect 1. I feel like we're trying to circle back to that a little bit. So that's kind of what's got me most excited for this. So.
Right. Oh yeah. And also the new planetary exploration that you do with probes now is really actually pretty cool. Like, I don't want to spoil anything, but I was, you know, you find anomalies out there in space, and found a couple satellites. I found a couple planets that had ore and stuff. And then I found a planet that actually had a spaceship that was abandoned, kind of, that was orbiting the planet, and it had like this little, you know, chunk of information about the ship. And the ship was really, the design on it was really cool. I don't want to say what race it was from, but and then of course you can salvage some of the ore from the ship, and you know, and use it for research and stuff like that. But I'm like, oh, like I love stuff like that. I love finding things. Yes. And my only fear is that like, oh, another satellite. I just hope it's not like, you know, that there's a lot of variety in the things that you discover, and not just like, oh, here's another ship. Like, I hope like it stays new and interesting.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean,
you remember in Mass Effect 1, there would be like, hey, it's a derelict ship. And then you would board the derelict ship and it'd be just like a little combat scenario, you know, with like,
right.
Maybe it'd be a ship that was infested with Geth. They all got turned to Geth or whatever. And then you'd kind of have to fight your way out of that. Right. So, I'm interested to see if there's kind of stuff like that too. Cause there were a lot of situations where you could get kind of like into like a little miniature horror story, like in a game like that. So I could see them maybe trying to call upon some of that stuff again too. So, I don't know. I think there's just, this is the tip of the iceberg. And I think that a lot of people out there, because, you know, this is like, we live in an age of immediacy that people want to, you know, put their thoughts out there and draw conclusions and pass judgment. Like after, you know, we only played what, like 6 hours of a maybe potentially 100-hour story if you go and do everything. Right.
Right.
And it's always like the roughest part of any RPG is the beginning, right? Where you have like no powers and you're just kind of getting started and learning all the ropes and everything like that. So,
right. I mean, and everybody's saying that the EA Access trial was basically the tutorial of the game.
Yes.
you know, where there's a lot of hand-holding, there's not a lot of player freedom. You can't really go anywhere and do everything, which is what the game is all about. So, you know, unfortunately, I'm kind of upset for the studio that they had to, you know, I don't know how it was set up, but I feel like, you know, the publisher probably said, this is something we have to do. I don't feel like it wasn't in the best interest of the game or the studio to have this EA access available to everyone prior to reviews. Mm-hmm. I feel like the reviews would be much stronger had all the stupid memes and stuff not popped out, you know, a couple days before the reviews came out, because, you know, if you have professional reviewers that get access to this first, they can formulate their own opinions without, you know, the gazing eye of the gaming community that have like played, you know, something that is, you know, has a flaw or two. So
yeah, I mean, it's that whole thing with like Syndicate and the exploding faces all over again. Like by the time I got around to playing that game, it was like awesome. It was completely awesome. And I saw nothing like that in the game when I played Syndicate. Right. So,
right.
Assassin's Creed Syndicate. So, or what was that? Brotherhood Syndicate? I think it was Syndicate, but,
I think it was Syndicate. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I totally agree with you. Like in a while, like in, you know, once people get into the game and start doing their own thing, this will be like much ado about nothing. And I really do think the game will stand on its own. But first of all, if you want to talk about handholding, my experience was a little different playing on Insanity on that first planet, because like you start out with the M3 Predator, and that's kind of brutal to start with that weapon and have to like try not to get yourself killed over and over again. But after playing through that prologue like 3 times, I got the hang of it. But you know, that's part of the fun.
Your brave soul.
Yeah,
Insanity on the first playthrough.
I like doing it. It's fun.
Oh man, crazy. Well, let's quickly, we're going to talk more about Mass Effect. We asked the question of the week to our community just this afternoon. We said, have you had a chance to play Mass Effect Andromeda? If so, let us know your thoughts and early impressions. And the first answer is from Jesse, who's at Gilberto3001. And Jesse says, tried to stick to multiplayer for the most part, loving the new mechanics, taking some getting used to, saving single player for main release. Can't wait.
Smart idea. I just want to add something as like a public service announcement is I still see people doing this. And I said, this about Mass Effect 3 too, is, don't stand in one place in multiplayer and try to like hold your ground. You know what I mean? You need to keep moving. So when the team is like getting all compacted together and all the enemies are closing in, it is time to go, right? So like, true. Yeah, keep the party going, keep it going. It's like a blender, makes it fun. Let's see, what's the next one? Carlo at Platinum Fist says, not yet, it pains me to say this, but I may hold off a bit in the middle of Rise of the Tomb Raider and have Horizon on deck. Need more time. We're definitely in a spring break of like humongous games like Horizon and Zelda,
and they're all good.
Yeah. And Mass Effect, and what was that? Near is the other one that people are
Near Automata. Everyone's loving that game too. Yeah,
so there you go.
Eric at eChap33 says, loving it so far, taking my time, enjoying the sights. Is the game perfect? No, but it's pretty close. 9.5 out of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Nice. Yeah. Stumpy Nat says, played a couple hours, sufficiently intrigued by the story. Hate the UI though, feels cluttered to me.
It's a little compact in some places. I do agree. I feel like they were trying to go for some kind of consistency across all the different parts of the game. But I think
Is it the same UI that was in the multiplayer we played?
It's kind of like a different UI altogether. So you kind of have to tab through some like screens at the top. So, you know, there have been times where I've missed icons at the top of the screen that I didn't realize I could, you know, I would be on an interface and I'd be like, oh, I can use, you know, the bumpers to tab between some different parts of this interface, stuff I didn't realize was there. So that happened to me a couple of times, but I mean, I think it's something to get used to, but it's definitely different from the last game. Andrew Baker at abakerN7 says, I haven't played, but I managed to watch some of the multiplayer streams. Looks amazing. I can't wait to dive in. I agree.
Multiplayer's still super fun.
Yes, that's going to be like the bee's knees when we all get in there together to play.
Jaffa Pug says, the combat is really polished and I enjoy talking to the Lady Krogans.
Mm-hmm.
Thumbs up.
Yep, true that.
You know, the main Lady Krogan in the game is a friend of the podcast, Allegra.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Small world.
Josh Silverman, Bear Punch, says, sunk 3 hours into the multiplayer and I'm absolutely in love with it. If single player is like this, but with story, then sold.
I believe that that will be the case. Nothing to fear there. Yep. And it's more environmental too, right? So not just like confined to a map, but you can, you know, there have been times where combat has gotten a little dicey and I've just hopped into Nomad, run the enemy over, hopped out and then fired at them some more. So I'm not, not too ashamed to say that. Kyle says, please, but not overwhelm. We'll play after Zelda. I have sort of a controversial opinion. Zelda is not holding my attention like I thought it would.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Like,
are you getting Skyrimmed from
that? I am.
Or not Oblivioned?
Yeah, I'm getting Oblivion because I get so lost and distracted that I'm not even like on the quest line. And it's just kind of like, I'll play for an hour and then I'll stop playing. I'll go like, what did I even just do? Did I just cook like three mushrooms and then like try to swim across the lake? And like, that's
it surprises me with you because you're much more capable of tracking games than I am most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So like, that's my problem, really, isn't that open world is bad or anything. It's just that I get like ADD'd and I just start like moving. I get distracted. Like, I'll be middle of mission and like, oh, and like just do something else entirely. And then that'll lead to doing something else, and that'll lead to, and then all of a sudden I'm like standing in the middle of a mountain and I'm like, where am I? That's and what am I supposed to be doing right now?
That's what happens. And I hope that taking a break will help me appreciate going back to Zelda, certainly. But I think part of it is also like, I open the game and I'm like, well, I got to stare at my inventory for 20 minutes, make sure I got the right weapons and food and potions.
At least
and stuff.
It's not two fantasy settings that you're going to play, you know, like at least you're getting, it is a break in a sense that you're moving to a new genre inside of a different open world.
Yeah. And my sort of counter argument to it is that like with Mass Effect, my brain is already so dialed into the, like the narrative, not the narrative, but like the world. And so like, it means more to me when we come upon a settlement and there's like a data pad that references some very obscure thing in the Mass Effect universe, but I know what that thing is, right? Like, I understand the game so much better than I do like the world of Zelda, that like it's easier for me to get lost because I don't feel like I'm getting lost because I'm doing something useful with my time.
Right.
So, there you go.
Cool. From our buddy Kate at Kate D. said, yes, it made me hungry for more Dragon Age. And then I don't know what that emoji is, but I'm going to let you guys tell me what it is.
Is it like
I think it's
like a smiley face with like angry eyebrows.
If you look at it the other way, it kind of looks like a chicken. Like if
or it's a frowny face with flat eyebrows.
I'll tell you what, Dragon Age made me hungry for more Mass Effect.
That's true.
It worked for me. Worked for me in the opposite.
Well, let's talk about it next week. We'll talk about more Mass Effect.
All right, sounds good.
All right. Thank you guys so much for listening to the Rated NA podcast. This was episode 268. You can follow us on Twitter, and that's at NerdAppropriate. You can email us directly, and that's Matt, Scott, or Ash at NerdAppropriate.com. We, of course, have a Twitch TV channel, which is /NerdAppropriate on Twitch TV, and same with Facebook, /NerdAppropriate on Facebook. Upcoming cons and stuff, I will be at Star Wars Celebration, so if you happen to be at Star Wars Celebration, please send us a tweet, say hi, love to meet up and hang out with you there. And other than that, there's not much else going on in our future. It's just a long, sweaty summer.
MEAMP, man, that's what it's all about. Yeah. Let's do that.
All right, thank you guys for listening.
Bye. So am I supposed to cut all that?
No, you can leave that in.
Okay,
I just didn't know if it'd be a bad story.
Okay. No, that's fine. Okay.
I was trying to keep it like PG-13, you know? Mm.